start, if you don't mind, with your background.
So I'm a Jewish American. I grew up in Michigan, going to Jewish schools and Jewish summer camps and Jewish youth groups, and traveled to Israel with my Jewish youth group in high school. And that got me super interested in Israel. And one next thing you know, 10 years later, I'm doing a PhD in Palestinian history. And over the past few years, I've launched a newsletter about Palestine. I tweet a lot about Palestine. I speak a lot about Palestine. My research is all about the origins and development of a Palestinian identity in the late Ottoman period, as well as a history of the idea of Palestine. Like, when did people actually use the word Palestine in history? For what reasons? In which time periods? And so I would say, generally speaking, the thing I've been doing the most of in the past couple of years is trying to translate academic research, as well as reports coming out of the NGOs, these very dense 500-page PDFs, trying to repackage that and repurpose that and make it more accessible for broader audiences. Because I do think there is a tremendous amount of interest in Israel-Palestine history specifically to understand what is happening today, to understand what led to October 7th. You need to understand the history, and not just the past 5 or 10 or 15 years of history, but really the past 140 years of history. Because so much of what we are learning about today has deep, deep roots. And so that's really the thing I've been so focused on over the past few years, is trying to make that academic research on Palestinian history, on the history of the Israel-Palestine question, more accessible to broader audiences.
You mentioned 140 years. A lot of pushback will occur immediately saying, no, we have to go back thousands of years.
Well, the question I would ask you in response would be, were Israelis and Palestinians killing each other thousands of years ago? Were they killing each other 500 years ago? Were they killing each other 200 years ago? The answer to all those questions is no. So when I go back and I want to understand the origins of the conflict itself, that is to say, the origins of when Palestinians and when Israelis started killing each other, that conflict dates to about, let's say, the 1880s. You might say 1870s. If you really want to, go back to the 1860s or 50s, fine. But, you know, if you want to go back much further than that, you're now entering the realm of propaganda. That's the realm of Zionist propaganda, or Palestinian propaganda for that matter, which is to say that Palestinian or Israeli or Jewish or other propagandists will go back in time to a point that is convenient for their narrative. We'll go back in time to a point where they claim their history starts in that place. Well, the problem with going back to when Jews claim they have a history beginning in Palestine, or when Palestinians claim they have a history beginning in Palestine, now you're embracing the propagandists rather than the historians' version of the history of the conflict. But if you want to leave the propaganda aside and just focus on the conflict itself, when did Israelis and Palestinians, or before Israelis they were Zionists, or before Palestinians, let's say they were Arabs, but when did Arabs and Zionists first start to kill each other? To my mind, that is the most sensible, the most neutral starting point to understand the origins of the conflict. You could really start the story of October 7th you could start it in 2007 when Hamas took power in the Gaza Strip, and after which point Israel imposed a land, sea, and air blockade. In other words, the moment when Israel waged a war on all 2 million people in Gaza for every minute of every hour of every day of every year for the past 16 years, Israel has been waging an unrelenting war on the civilian population of Gaza. So in my mind, that is the most sensible place to start the story. If you want to go back further than that, you could start with the origins of Hamas, which you could date to, say, 1987-88. But even to understand the origins of Hamas, you have to understand the first 20 years of Israeli military occupation, which began in 1967. And really, to understand the deep roots of the rise of Hamas, you probably have to go all the way back to 48, which is when all these Palestinians who founded Hamas were made into refugees and pushed into Gaza in the first place. And so you could really start in 48, you could start in 67, you could start in 87, or you could start in 2007, depending on how far back into history you want to go. As it relates to October 7th, the key things to know about the 48 war would be, number one, something like two-thirds of the entire population, Arab population of Palestine, became refugees, were made refugees during that war, including, by the way, the founders of Hamas themselves, right? So we're talking The founder of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, he is from a village in what became Israel. And during that 1948 war, when Palestinian Arabs and Jewish Zionists fought a war over Palestine, the Zionist forces and then the Israeli forces, they expelled something like 750,000 Palestinians from Palestine. Many of them, about 200,000 of them, became refugees in Gaza. And so if you even, you've probably heard many times already, but you know, 75% of the people currently living in Gaza today are either themselves refugees or descendants of those those 200,000 refugees that were made refugees during the 1948 war. So that's really sort of the starting point to understand actually that the people who founded Hamas were made refugees by Israel during that war. The second maybe thing worth saying about that war was that in the immediate aftermath of the 1948 war, from the end of 1948 until 1949, 1950, so for about a year and a half, 2 years after the end of the war, after the guns fell silent in 1948, you had many tens of thousands of Palestinians trying to return to their homes after the war to see family, to recover property, to harvest crops. And in just that first 2 years, from end of 48 until 1950, the Israeli military had a shoot-to-kill policy. Any of these refugees trying to return to their homes were shot and killed. And Israel killed more than 1,000 Palestinian unarmed refugees during that first 2 years. And then just to continue the story forward, in 1956, Israel had, and so after Israel were slaughtering these Palestinian refugees returning home, many Palestinians picked up arms and started to fight back. And those Palestinians became known as the Fedayeen. And then, so they started carrying out cross-border raids against Israeli towns in the years after 1950. And in 1956, Israel had the brilliant idea of, quote-unquote, eradicating Palestinian violent military resistance coming out of the Gaza Strip. And so they entered the entered the Gaza Strip in October 1956 as part of what I would call a neo-colonial war, the Suez Crisis, as it's known. They occupied Gaza for 6 months, from October 56 until March 1957. And in November 1956, they entered Khan Yunis. November 3rd, they went from door to door. They grabbed every 15-year-old male, every male above the age of 15, lined them up in the city center of Khan Yunis, and slaughtered them. It was a massacre. Abdulaziz Rantisi, one of the co-founders of Hamas, 2 decades later, he was an 8-year-old boy at the time living in the Khan Yunis camp. He bore witness to the events of November 1956. And so I think it's worth keeping in mind, or at least perhaps worth asking ourselves, how many 8-year-old children today in Gaza are witnessing the atrocities that are taking place on an order of maybe 2 to 3 orders of magnitude more ferocious and more violent and more deadly than the 1956 massacre. Let's just put a pin in that and continue forward, right? So, you know, as we said, 48 is really the starting point. But really, to understand kind of the rise of Hamas, I think you have to go back to 67, when Israel occupied Gaza not for 6 months, but for the past 56 years. It occupied, of course, not just Gaza, but also the West Bank. And during its first 20 years of military occupation, from 67 to 87, Israel denied Palestinians basic political rights. Palestinians are now being controlled by the Israeli military. They do not have a right to vote for the government that controls their lives. They're not allowed to wave a Palestinian flag. They're not allowed to paint a painting using green, black, red, and white. Because, of course, that would be violent and dangerous. And in fact, a Palestinian by the name of Fateh Rabban sat 6 months in an Israeli prison in 1982 for using those four colors in a painting. Right. So we're talking about 20 years of brutal military occupation in which Israel is killing on average 32 Palestinians every year for 20 years, long before there are any terrorist organizations based in the West Bank or Gaza. Israel is imposing daily, physically assaulting Palestinians at checkpoints. Israel is confiscating large swaths of land in Gaza and in the West Bank. And so we're talking about a policy, a brutal military occupation. They're detaining and deporting any Palestinian who resists Israeli rule. So between 67 and 87, Israel deports thousands of Palestinians to outside of the territories. And of course, after 20 years of this occupation, we get a revolt. We get an uprising in which Palestinians, primarily using nonviolent means, rise up and reject the state of subjugation in which they're living. And so, and during the first year of that revolt, from late 87 until late 88, Israel enters Gaza and slaughters 142 Palestinians in Gaza and suffers zero casualties in response because it's basically a nonviolent revolt. It's primarily Palestinian youth throwing stones at Israeli tanks. And lo and behold, during that same year, when Israel slaughters all these Palestinians, that's exactly the same year during which Hamas transitions from a charity organization to a militant resistance group. And so that is really, I think, to really understand the origins of October 7th, you got to go back to the first intifada, the first uprising, during which time Hamas really makes that transition. And it's a much more gradual transition than most people realize. And I would first start off by saying it didn't have to end the way it ended. Hamas made peace overtures to Israel in the months leading up to August 1988, when it first adopted its infamous charter, during which it calls for an Islamic state over all of Palestine, and in which it declares the Jews the enemies of the Palestinian people. And so, just to point out a few of these meetings that have been almost completely forgotten, even by historians, even by specialists, not to mention the general public, you have in March 1988, so we're talking 4 or 5 months before Hamas embraces its violent charter, you have Hamas leaders, Mahmoud Azahar, go to Tel Aviv, meet with then Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, and try to open up a channel, a negotiation channel for peace. And then on June 1st, 1988, Mahmoud Azahar goes back to Tel Aviv and presents a document to then Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin, in which he says, if Israel declares its intention to withdraw from the Palestinian occupied territories, it doesn't even have to withdraw, it just has to declare its intent to withdraw. And it allows a UN a peacekeeping force or some other third party, some other neutral third party, to take over the territories. And then if it allows Palestinians to elect their own representatives without any Israeli interference, we're open to peace. But of course, that that peace offer fell on deaf ears. Israel had no intention of withdrawing from the occupied territories. In fact, to the contrary, over the previous 6 years, from 1982 to 1988, the Israeli government tripled its settler population in the occupied territories. It was in the process of dramatically expanding its control of the occupied territories in strategic locations that it wanted to maintain permanent military presence in. So those peace offers fell on deaf ears. Hamas instead embraces violence, and it's a very gradual embrace. And during its first, I would say, 6 years, from 1988 to 1994, the majority of Hamas attacks are against Israeli military targets. And that's, by the way, the reason that the United States government doesn't even put Hamas on the terrorist watch list until 1996, right? So it's a very gradual transition during which first Hamas starts to target Israeli military targets. And then after Baruch Goldstein, an American from Brooklyn, enters the Ibrahimi Mosque and slaughters 29 Palestinian worshippers during Ramadan, that is when Hamas really becomes radicalized and starts to carry out all of these gruesome attacks on Israeli civilians in buses and cafes for the next, call it, 8 or 9 years, from 1994 until 2004 or 5. Yeah, so that's really the most gruesomely violent period is, I would say, it's really not until 2000. I mean, even for the next 6 years, Hamas is carrying out two dozen attacks, killing about 150 Israelis from 94 to 2000, during which time, of course, Israel is imposing mass lockdowns, locking down Palestinians in place, imposing checkpoints, preventing Palestinian freedom of movement. And those periods, the most intense periods, in 95 and 96, when Israel locks down Gaza and the West Bank, we're talking for months and months at a time, that leads to 70% unemployment rate in Gaza during peak lockdowns. And in the West Bank, it results in about 50% unemployment, again, during periods of peak lockdowns in 95, 96, and 97. And this, of course, is during the period in which Israel is supposed supposed to be building trust with the Palestinians, right? It's during the Oslo period when the Israelis are supposed to be gradually transferring over control of certain cantons within the West Bank and Gaza to the Palestinian Authority. And it's precisely during this time when Israel is actually eroding trust by crushing the Palestinian economy, leading the Palestinian GDP per capita to decline by 33% during this period. And then the negotiations break down in 2000. Happy to get into that if you're curious. But I mean, that's a whole nother conversation. But basically, after Ariel Sharon takes this very provocative visit on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, what the Israelis call the Temple Mount, during which he's essentially asserting sovereignty over the holiest site to Palestinian Muslims, the third holiest site in all of Islam, this leads to protests. And the next day, Israel kills, I believe, three Palestinian children. This is September 2000. And then over the course of the next 3 weeks, Israeli military personnel shoot and kill 14 Palestinian children without having really experienced any casualties themselves. And that, of course, unleashes Hamas's fury again. And over the course of the next 5 years, really from 2000 to 2005, Hamas, as well as Islamic Jihad, as well as Fatah, you know, they have a military wing as well. But all of these Palestinian armed groups start to carry out dozens, if not hundreds, of attacks on Israeli civilians and kill more than 1,000 Israeli civilians from 2000 to 2005. And Israel, of course, does what it always does, which is it responds with disproportionate violence and kills 3,000 Palestinians during that same time period. And that kind of brings us to the 2006 January elections that were, by the way, encouraged by George Bush at the time, right? He tells the Palestinians, you know, democracy, rah-rah. He was the one that actually pushed the Palestinians to hold elections. Palestinians hold elections, legislative elections, and Hamas wins. And this is, of course, great surprise to everyone, including the United States. And so they, of course, supported democracy before the election, but when they didn't like the result, they opposed democracy. And in fact, what they do together in collaboration with Israel is they arm Mahmoud Dahlan, who is the Palestinian Fatah, a military commander in Gaza. They provide him arms and provide him support and tell him, you know, basically go kill all the Hamas people, go arrest all the Hamas militants. And that leads to basically a civil war, is what I would describe it, in Gaza in June 2007, during which, guess what? Hamas comes out on top again. And so Hamas is now in charge of Gaza, beginning in June 2007, which is when Israel imposes its land, sea, and air blockade over the Gaza Strip, which is, of course, illegal under international law because the stated goal of the blockade was to punish the people of Gaza for having elected Hamas. And, of course, imposing a blockade on 2 million civilians is illegal because it is imposing collective punishment on a civilian population, which, of course, is illegal. And, I mean, we can get into the details of that blockade, but it has been had an absolutely catastrophic impact on all 2 million people in Gaza, right? You know, you've had unemployment rates fluctuate from 40 to 60% on average over the past 16 years. You had almost no one allowed to leave Gaza over the past 16 years. You're talking children born and raised in essentially an open-air prison in which they have no employment opportunities. Right today, the youth unemployment rate is about 60, 70%. You know, today, sorry, not today, but, you know, on the eve of October 7th, roughly 50% of households in Gaza, they had to make sacrifices on their health, you know, healthcare, utility bills, just to be able to put enough food on the table. 80% of Palestinians in Gaza, again, these are all data points on the eve of October 7th, so before October 7th. Obviously, everything has gotten dramatically worse since then. But on the eve of October 7th, 80% of households in Gaza were dependent on food aid, right? Like, families don't have enough money just to be able to put enough food on the table. You know, 97% of the water in Gaza is undrinkable. So when you turn on a faucet and this is before October 7th, of course, when you turn on a faucet in Gaza City or in Khan Yunis or in Rafah, it's salty water that comes out. So Palestinians have to spend a huge amount of their budget just on bottled water, getting safe drinking water. It's a catastrophic situation in which Palestinians don't even have enough electricity to survive on. Of course, Israel controls electricity. And so roughly the single operating power plant in Gaza prior to October 7th had only 50% the amount of electricity they needed, which has, again, disastrous consequences on every sector of the economy of Gaza. Of course, it has dramatic consequences on the health sector. In 2022 alone, about 20,000 Palestinians were denied exit permits to leave Gaza for medical reasons, right? Because, you know, you have 2 million people, you don't have proper medical care in Gaza. You can't perform many operations. There's many things that cannot be done in Gaza owing to the blockade. And so you get tens of thousands of Palestinians applying for these exit permits to get medical treatment in Egypt or in the West Bank or in Israel proper. And in 2022 alone, 20,000 Palestinians were denied exit permits, and we know there are many documented cases, dozens of Palestinians, if not hundreds, if not thousands of Palestinians, die every year because they cannot get access to preventable healthcare just to survive. And in one case, Fatima al-Masri, a 2-year-old Palestinian girl, was denied an exit permit to receive life-saving medical treatment, and she died as a result of that. And she's of course not a unique case. We know of many other cases like her. So we were talking about a situation in which, you know, basically the people have no hope. They have not enough food to live off of. They do not have fresh water. There is not adequate medical care. They experience daily blackouts ranging from 2 to 12 hours every day. They live in an open-air prison. They have to forego utility bills. They do not have enough money to access proper health care or even put enough food on the table. And all that was before October 7th. You know, I mean, and we could talk about the 5 wars that Israel has waged on Gaza. So from 2007, when Israel imposed its blockade on Gaza, to October 6, 2023, Israel waged 5 wars on Gaza, during which it killed 3,500 Palestinian civilians. We're not talking about militants. We're talking about Palestinian civilians. And in every one of those 5 wars, in 2008, in 2012, in 2014, in 2018-19, again in 2021, human rights organizations like the UN, like Amnesty International, and like Human Rights Watch have documented cases in which Israel intentionally targeted civilians. Just to cite a few of those examples, okay, in 2008, the Goldstone Report, they conducted investigations on 11 strikes during which Israel killed innocent civilians. And in 10 out of the 11 strikes, so more than 90% of the strikes on Gaza in the 2008-2009 war, the Goldstone Report, which is a UN report, found that there were no justifiable military targets. In other words, the goal of the 2008-2009 Israeli war on the people of Gaza was to terrorize the civilian population of Gaza. That was the goal. That was the stated goal of that operation. And basically every war, in varying degrees, has more or less, Israel has more or less done the same thing. In 2014, something like 40% of the strikes were targeting Palestinian civilians where no military target was identified. The estimate in the 2021 war was 70% of the strikes had no justifiable military target. And in the 2018 war, that many people don't call a war, but it killed more people than the 2012 war, which everyone calls a war, so I'm not sure why that's not even called a war. But in the 2018 war, during which Gazans peacefully marched towards the wall, protesting against the siege, protesting for the right of return, Israel slaughtered 250 Palestinians over the course of a year. And on one day alone, on May 14th, 2018, the Israeli army slaughtered 60 Palestinians on a single day. It was a massacre. It was Israeli snipers literally gunning down Palestinians, Palestinian medics, Palestinians wearing press vests. It didn't matter. If you were a Palestinian and you were protesting peacefully, you were shot and killed. They injured 6,000 people with life-changing wounds. Again, and how many Israeli soldiers were killed in response? Zero. It was a massacre. And on the same day that Israel slaughtered 60 Palestinians in Gaza, you had an American delegation in Jerusalem celebrating Israel's capital of Jerusalem. The American embassy moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And it was on May 14th, that same day, that the American government, together with Israel, celebrated...
Yeah, Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, celebrating Israel's illegal annexation of East Jerusalem on the same day that Israel is slaughtering defenseless Palestinian protesters. And that kind of brings us up to October 7th, which obviously, you know, we're talking about a scale of humanitarian catastrophe far, far greater, perhaps 2 to 3 orders of magnitude greater destruction and death and disability and despair than anything we've ever seen in the 140-year history of the Israel-Palestine conflict.
What is Palestine?
Palestine is it's a place. It's located in the exact same place as Israel. So let's talk about these words very briefly, right? So between 1920 and 1948, the British government established a British Mandate for Palestine. That was the name of the country. Of course, that mandate for Palestine was imposed against the political will of 85% of the people of Palestine, who said, how about democracy? How about just let us vote for our own representatives? And the British were like, nah, we're more into like colonialism and colonial domination. So sorry. So the name of the country for those 28 years was Palestine. And it was uncontroversial, by the way. You know, the Jews themselves called the place Palestine. The Zionists called the place Palestine. It was an uncontroversial name. That was the name of the country, okay? And then in English, right? In Hebrew, of course, the Jews called the place Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. And the reason they called it the land of Israel in Hebrew rather than Palestine is because... Hebrew had been a dead language for 2,000 years, right? So Hebrew was an ancient language spoken by the ancient Israelites more than 2,000 years ago. But already from the time when the Romans, destroyed the Bar Kokhba revolt in 140 CE, even by that point, the name the name Israel had was long gone, was not even being used at that time. The Jews of the first second century BC called it Judea. So basically, Israel had fallen out of use, and the Hebrew language was no longer a spoken language. And so for 2,000 years, Hebrew was used as a written language, and it was a kind of lingua franca for the Jewish people for written purposes. When a Jew in Spain or in Morocco or in Iraq would write, a commentary on the Bible, or they would write a commentary on the Mishnah or the Talmud, they would oftentimes be writing in Hebrew. It was a written language, so it survived as a written language. And for that reason, it didn't embrace much of the geographical lexicon. It wasn't impacted by the changes, the colloquial changes that had, that were taking place over the course of those intervening 2,000 years. So in spoken language, Jews around the world were calling the place Palestine in the 18th and 19th century, but the written language never embraced, never adopted those new words, especially Palestine. And so even in Hebrew literature, if you read Hebrew writings by Jewish scholars and rabbis in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, they're not calling the place Palestine. They're calling the place Eretz Yisrael. So in Hebrew, the phrase Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, is preserved. And so then when, in the late 19th century, when these Zionists are reviving the Hebrew language, the word Palestine had never been embraced in Hebrew. And so they're continuing to call the place Eretz Yisrael in Hebrew really throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. And so basically you have these two words, Palestine, which is being used in English and French and all the Western languages. And then you have, of course, including Arabic and Persian and Ottoman Turkish, it's being called, Philistine in Arabic or Philistine in Ottoman Turkish. So that's the name in Arabic and Turkish and English and German is Palestine. But in Hebrew, the name is the land of Israel. And so then when Jews realize they actually want to embrace Hebrew, that Hebrew is the national language of the Jewish people, and we want to revive this this Hebrew language. Great. They revive Israel along with that name. So now you have two competing names to describe exactly the same place. And then it really beginning when in 1948, when Israel establishes a state in the land of Israel. You know, basically, there's this war that is waged on the word Palestine, because the word Palestine is the name used by the Palestinians, by the Arabs. And so because of the national conflict, because they don't want people to call the place Palestine, they don't want the Palestinians to call themselves Palestinians, because, of course, it's the same place, and but they want to establish a Jewish state in that land. There's now a war being waged on the word Palestine, and that war really, you could say, develops in earnest in the 1960s, and has been continually waged by Israel and its apologists and its supporters abroad. That is to say, this place is not called Palestine, and even to this day, you know, if you tell a Jew or an Israeli, if you just call the country Palestine, it raises the ire of Jews and of Israelis and of Israel supporters. They don't want you to call that word, use the word Palestine. And so Palestine is a place. It's the same place as the land of Israel. It's just a different name for it. That has been used by the native inhabitants. And that's the reason, why there is so much controversy around it. It's because Israel and its supporters have wanted you to think that it's a controversial word. Oh my God, Palestine, even though they themselves use the word for many decades, if not many centuries. And even though it's has continually been the word used by Palestinian, inhabitants as the name of the country.
I mean, it sounds like a ridiculous question, but I had a conversation a few days ago with somebody who was saying, well, it's a recognized country. And I said, well, is it? Because the United States doesn't recognize it as a country. I don't see it on a map.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Palestine, I would say these days has oftentimes become synonymous with the occupied Palestinian territories. Right, so, you know, the territories that Israel occupied in 1967 now have become conflated with the word Palestine, in part because Mahmoud Abbas, I believe, was it 2012 or 2013, he declared Palestine a state. Right, he said, you know, it was a UN General Assembly resolution, I believe, that may have even I think voted in support of recognizing the state of Palestine, in reference to the occupied Palestinian territories of Gaza, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank. So now, you know, the word continues to evolve in its usage, and now you might say that Palestine has at least two different meanings. One is, say, all of quote-unquote historic Palestine, British Mandatory Palestine, which is today everything between the river and the sea, right? Israel proper, the West Bank, and Gaza all together, that's Palestine. But then it now has a second meaning as well, which is just the occupied territories of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza.
What is Zionism?
So Zionism is the belief that the Jewish people have self-determination rights in the land of Israel-Palestine. That's the most simplistic definition, is to say that the Jewish people have a right to statehood, to political sovereignty in Israel-Palestine. I think that's the most simple definition and the most inclusive definition. Of course, there are many strains of Zionism. There's political Zionism, religious Zionism, cultural Zionism. But I think all Zionisms would agree on that one point. The problem with Zionism is that, and the problem with establishing a Jewish state is that Palestine is majority non-Jewish, right? And has been majority non-Jewish for the entirety of the past 140 years. In the 1920s, I mean, going back to the 1880s, when Zionists first came up with the idea of establishing a Jewish state in Palestine, Palestine was 90%+ non-Jewish. And then even when the British declared the Balfour Declaration and declared their intent to transform Palestine into a Jewish state, Palestine was still 85% non-Jewish. So the problem with Zionism is that how is it? I mean, let me ask you this question. How do you establish a Jewish state in a land that is mostly non-Jewish? Well, you have different options, right? If you're of the belief that, you know, Zionists are going to bring all of these benefits to the non-Jews, then you might believe that maybe the non-Jews would be okay. They would accept political subjugation if it meant economic benefits. And that was certainly one camp. And that's kind of that camp continues to this day. The Jared Kushner plan, the Peace to Prosperity plan, is a kind of the reincarnation of that idea that, right, if only we invest in enough money, if only we get the Saudis and the Emirates to invest tens of billions of dollars in Palestine, then the West Bank and Gaza and Palestinians will accept political subjugation because, you know, of the benefits provided, especially the financial benefits. So that's one perspective. There's a middle ground which says, you know, the Palestinians, you know, they're probably not going to accept political subjugation. But again, with the right incentives, we can make it work. And if we're just delicate and careful enough, and, you know, we're polite and we're kind, and we sort of treat them as really nice second-class citizens, like they'll be okay with it. I mean, that's kind of like the liberal Zionist approach. But then you have, I would say, you know, the mainstream Zionist approach, which dominates Israeli politics today, and it has for the past decade and a half, is the more conservative Zionist approach, which says, no, the Palestinians have deep roots in the country. They have a strong national identity. And they're just not going to subject, they're not willing to accept second-class citizenship in the case of Israel proper. They're not willing to accept permanent occupation or apartheid in the case of the West Bank. And they're not willing to accept total siege and blockade and basically imprisonment in the case of Gaza. And so the only solution is the quote-unquote Iron Wall, which is you have to beat them into acceptance. You have to, you know, expose them to disproportionate violence. That was what Ben Gurion, Israel's founding father, told Ariel Sharon in 1956 when he was entering Gaza to root out the Fedayeen. He said, you're going to need to use disproportionate violence. These people need to learn a lesson, and the only way to teach them to accept Israeli domination and Jewish domination is through violence. And I would say that has been the primary, I would say, strategy that Israel and Zionists before them have embraced in order to get Palestinians to accept Zionism, to accept Jewish domination in all of Palestine.
How do you explain Christian Zionism, which is massive in the United States?
So Christian Zionism is a very, very old phenomenon. In fact, it predates Jewish Zionism. I mean, people don't realize this. But many of the earliest Zionists in Europe, as well as the United States, were Christian. They were not Jewish. And there were a few reasons for this. In Europe, the Christian Zionists, first of all, they had these eschatological beliefs that at the end of days, there will be a Jewish ingathering in the Holy Land, and that will bring about the second coming of Jesus Christ. So there's this, and I'm not a theologian, so please don't ask me to share details about that eschatological fantasy. But that is certainly what many European Christians, and also, by the way, what many American Christian Zionists today believe. So that, I would say, is an underlying much of the support for Israel, is these fantastical eschatological beliefs about ultimately, essentially, Jews all burning in hell is kind of how I think they imagined it at the end of days, which is a little funny when you consider that, you know, they have so much support in Israel. I mean, they're probably the number one allies of the state of Israel in the United States. There's almost no American that supports Israel in the same way that Pat Robertson and all these American evangelical Christians support Israel. I mean, it's a blank check. It makes Joe Biden look like Israel's greatest critic, right? So there's this eschatological reason. But I think if you go back historically, the other reason you had so many Christian Zionists in Europe was because of anti-Semitism. It's because these Christians, you know, basically believe that Jews were, they killed Jesus Christ, that, you know, they were filthy and dirty and were a plague on Europe. And gosh, wouldn't it be great if we can get them all to leave? And so Zionism was this very useful strategy by many Christian Zionists. In fact, the guy who came up with the word anti-Semitism, who's credited with having come up with the word, I believe he's Hungarian. He was a Hungarian anti-Semite. And in the late 1870s and 1880s, he coins this term anti-Semitism. And he's basically of the belief that the way Hungary is going to achieve greatness is through this anti-Semitic Zionist program of pushing all the Jews out of Hungary and convincing them to move to Palestine. So there was actually quite a great ideological alignment between these Christian Zionists, who many of them were anti-Semites, and the earliest Zionists. And there were you know, alliances, and you know, many of them were in conversation with Theodor Herzl and the Zionist movement in Europe. And so that and you could just carry that tradition to the present day. You know, many, I would say, of the most anti-Semitic, the most vile anti-Semites in the U.S. are also some of the greatest Zionists. Again, based on this belief that, you know, get the Zionists out of America, get the Zionists out of Europe, send them to Palestine, where they're all, where they will all eventually, you know, burn in hell. But that's kind of a short, I would say, a short version of the story of Christian Zionism.
So just going back to what you're talking about earlier, it sounds as if you're saying Israel doesn't have a right to exist.
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. I think Israel, like any other country today, has a right to exist. I think Egypt has a right to exist, even though the Egyptian military slaughtered 1,000 Egyptians in Rabaa Adawiyah and Nasser City in 2013. Right, I think Saudi Arabia has a right to exist, even though it has killed tens of thousands of Yemeni children over the past decade. Right, the United States has a right to exist just because it illegally invaded Iraq and occupied it for more than a decade. Right, so, you know, just because a country is committing grotesque violence and maybe even carrying out a genocide, that doesn't mean it doesn't have the right to exist. What I would say is. It doesn't have the right to be practicing apartheid. It doesn't have a right to treat Palestinians as second-class citizens. It doesn't have a right to carry out genocidal wars against the Palestinians in Gaza. That's what it doesn't have a right to do. But a right to exist, I mean, this is a propaganda point. This is what Israelis will try and tell you to make you convinced that the whole world is anti-Semitic. But again, like, when have you ever even heard that phrase used against other violent regimes? Against other complete, like, North Korea? Have you ever heard someone say, North Korea doesn't have a right to exist? Well, North Korea may be the most oppressive country on earth, but it doesn't mean it doesn't have a right to exist. Like, that, even that language that is used is language used by Israel's apologists and propagandists to make everyone think there's this kind of unrelenting campaign of anti-Semitism, but that is not a word or a phrase used by Israel's critics. What Israel does not have a right to do is impose apartheid and discriminate and carry out genocidal wars. That is what Israel does not have a right to do. In my view, there are at least three things that need to happen, maybe four. Like, where do we go from here? So first of all, we need an immediate ceasefire. You just saw the reports yesterday. I believe it was a Save the Children report. Perhaps it was an Oxfam report. More than 50% of people in North Gaza are starving to death. We're talking about actual starvation. Most people basically go a full day with no food in the north of Gaza. They are starving to death. In South Gaza, the number is more like 38-39% of people are starving to death. They're all dehydrating as well. Most of them are living in open air shelters. 1.9 million people are homeless now. So we need a ceasefire so that we can get food and water to the people who are literally starving to death as you and I speak right now. So that's step one. I think, step two is stop the violence in the West Bank. More than 1,000 Palestinians in the West Bank have been ethnically cleansed from their homes in just the past 2 months. More than 220 Palestinians have been murdered in the past 2 months. Where there is no Gaza, or where there is no Hamas operations, where there is no Hamas government. So to pretend like this is like the problem here is Hamas is to ignore what the real problem is, which is that it's the Israeli occupation and Israeli violence and Israeli apartheid, all of which create the conditions for Palestinian violence. So then the second thing is we need, once we stop slaughtering Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank and get them the needed aid and food and water just to survive, then we need a political process. Now, what does the political process need to involve? Number one, Palestinians and Israelis need to be equal. They need to have equal seats at the table. We cannot return to the old Oslo framework in which Israel is both party to the agreement, but also the enforcer of the agreement, right? That was Oslo. It was Israel and Palestinians saying, you know what? Let's agree to divide up the water in the West Bank. Israel gets 80% and Palestinians get 20%. But oh, by the way, Israel actually is the one that makes the ultimate decision on how much water goes to which sides. And so Israel takes 90-95% rather than 80. Or in the case of the Hebron Accords of 1998, when Bibi Netanyahu said, I will only sign this stage of the Oslo process if I, and exclusively I, i.e. Israel, the Israeli military, gets to define an Israeli military facility. Well, if Israel is both party to an agreement that says basically Israel has to withdraw its military from certain parts of the West Bank, but then it's Israel that gets to decide what is a military facility, well, then what results is a process in which the entire Jordan Valley is therefore defined as a military facility. And that's exactly what Israel did. It said, oh, by the way, I know we said we're going to withdraw from all these parts of the West Bank, but we also said that, you know, we get to define what is a military facility and we're allowed to maintain those military facilities in certain parts, even though we said we withdraw from them, which actually means we won't withdraw from any of them because it's all a military facility. Excuse me. And so in a world where Israel both is a party to the agreement, where it's also an enforcer of the agreement and also defines the rules of the engagements of the agreement, you're just back to Oslo, which is essentially a cover fire and a smokescreen for Israeli settlement expansion and Israeli occupation enterprise expansion. And that's what Oslo basically was, right? So we can't return to that framework. The only framework that will work is one in which Israel and the Palestinians are equal. And the only way to achieve that is having a neutral third party that applies real pressure on both sides, basically Israel, right, to allow the Palestinians to have an equal seat at that negotiating table. And the final point I will make about these negotiations will be that they have to include all militant groups, all groups that are party to the conflict. And this was another fundamental flaw of the Oslo process, which was that the Oslo Accords were an agreement between Israel and the PLO. The same PLO that had already renounced violence in 1988, 5.5 years before the signing of the accords. Now, let me ask you this. How did Israel expect to solve, quote-unquote, the Israel-Palestine conflict without the groups that were at the time attacking Israel, right? In the 5 years prior to the signing of the Oslo Accords, from 88 to 93, the vast majority of the attacks that were carried out by Palestinians on Israeli military and civilian targets were from Hamas and Islamic Jihad. But they were totally excluded from the Oslo process. Right? So how is it that you expect to come to some kind of political solution that ends the violence without the groups causing the violence? So Oslo was honestly like, it had no hope. It had no chance of solving the problem because it didn't even include the people causing the violence in the first place. So you need a new political process, one in which Palestinians and Israelis have equal seats at the table, one in which there's a neutral third party that applies real pressure to make sure that those two parties have equal seats at the table, and one in which includes all Palestinian groups, both armed groups and as well as civil society groups, as well as Palestinians in exile. I'm not saying this is going to be easy to do, but I'm saying that's what you need in order to come to an eventual political resolution to this conflict.
But that's not going to happen because the Palestinians are the majority.
Palestinians are a majority. Look, I think there are a lot of ideas on the table. There are these, you know, one idea that I found to be quite innovative is like, you know, basically what's it? It's like one country, two states, kind of where like basically all Palestinians and all Israelis can move and travel freely anywhere between Israel and Palestine, and that Palestinians will have citizenship in the Palestinian state but can move and, you know, apply for citizenship in the Israeli state and vice versa. And so that's an innovative idea has been repeated, I think, has gotten renewed attention in the past few weeks. There's a one state idea. There's, you know, the classic two state idea. I don't think the number of states or the exact configuration of those states actually is the real issue. The real issue is a commitment to human rights, is a commitment to making sure everyone, no matter what their religion is or what their ethnic or national identity is, has human rights, has political rights, is able to vote for the government or the governments that control their lives, has a right to freedom of movement between the river and the sea, has, you know, a right to hear, to be tried in a civil court that does not have a 99.7% conviction rate, as is the case with the Palestinians currently in the West Bank, right? So you need to give people rights. and exactly the political configuration. Let the Palestinians work that out. But ultimately, right now, what Palestinians and Israelis both need is security and human rights. And whatever the framework is, whether it's one state or two states or some one country, two states or two countries, one state, or however you want to define it, I don't think that's the key issue. The key issue is human rights and security. And until Israelis and Palestinians both have that, until Palestinians have real security and Palestinians have real human rights, there's no chance Israelis will ever have a security as well.
Israel is this tiny country in the Middle East, and the Muslims want to wipe it out. And so therefore they have to maintain this Jewish majority.
Well, Israel has a very positive relationships with many Muslim countries, right? As you just saw in 2002, it signed the Abraham Accords, in which it basically signed normalization deals with Morocco and Sudan and the UAE and Bahrain. It had already had, diplomatic relations with Egypt and Jordan, as well as other Muslim countries around the Muslim world. So this idea that there's a conflict between Muslims and the Muslim countries and Israel is a myth. By the way, Israel has, more than 1 million Muslim citizens, right? So there's no problem with Muslims and Israel. The problem is dominating and controlling the lives of millions of Palestinians. That's the problem. And we know already from the 2001, the Arab Peace Initiative, during which had the support of Saudi Arabia and every single Arab and Muslim country, that the Muslim and Arab worlds are open to peace. You just can't dominate the lives of millions of Palestinians and slaughter them whenever you want and impose an apartheid regime on them. That's what you can't do. That's the problem.
Why aren't neighboring Arab countries taking in the Gazans?
Well, there's only real one country that could. It's Egypt. I'm not sure how Gazans would be able to get to any other Arab country, without the explicit approval of the state of Israel, which obviously they don't have. But really, from the point of view of Egypt, there's a few issues. Number one, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi stated explicitly he doesn't want Palestinians to establish bases of military operations from Egyptian soil from which they could then attack Israel. That's a very legitimate concern. But of course, recall that Abdel Fattah al-Sisi himself imprisoned 60,000 members of the Muslim Brotherhood. He is no friend of the Palestinian people of Egypt, of Gaza. Right, he has no desire he's not some kind of noble Arab leader who's looking out for the Palestinians. He also is worried that if he opens the border and lets Palestinians into Egypt, which he should, to allow people who want to leave for humanitarian reasons. But he's worried that if he does that, the Egyptian people will accuse him of being complicit in a second Nakba, in a second ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. And he knows that there's one issue that the Egyptian people that will kind of rile up the Egyptian street. He's a brutal dictator, right? And knows that he will face real protests if he opens up that border and is essentially perceived to be complicit in the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people of Gaza. So he doesn't want that either. I think those would be the two main reasons. I agree with you that he obviously should open the border to allow anyone who wants to leave Gaza to leave Gaza. The worry, of course, is that they will not be allowed back, right? That they will become refugees and ultimately, long-term, be in just as bad, if not worse, a position as they are today.
Where do you see this going?
Ultimately, Bibi Netanyahu is worried that if the war ends, the Israeli public, 80% of whom hold him accountable for what happened on October 7th, he will have to pay the price. And that price will be his own political survival. Israelis will vote him out of power. And ultimately, if he's voted out of power, he will face the bribery charges and corruption charges and breach of public trust charges that he's been facing for years now. So I think if it were up to Netanyahu, this is a forever war. Israel will never leave Gaza. The war will go on forever. If he gets his way. Now, I imagine there will be pressure on him to end the war because there'll be hundreds, if thousands of Palestinians starving to death and dehydrating. So eventually there will be pressure applied on him, but I would expect this to get worse and the war to last longer before it gets better or before it ends.
Okay, I know you have to go, so I'm going to invite you back. But for now, Zachary, how can I follow you?
You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is _ZachFoster. I run a newsletter called Palestine in Your Inbox, which you can subscribe to at palestinenexus.com.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.